Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
The city has to always look to evolve. And throughout our history, we have evolved. We've diversified our economy. We've addressed serious issues of quality of life. And we've retained that vibrancy that makes it so attractive to generation after generation of young people and young families and the workforce that is the lifeblood of our city.
How do we evolve our downtowns to ensure their survival in a post-pandemic world? Today, we look at the exodus from city centres and how to revive them. Do we need to rethink how we use our office buildings? Will working from home kill off the CBD? Do businesses have a responsibility to the areas where they place their headquarters? We answer all those questions and more today, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Welcome to today's programme. It's certainly been a strange year to be an office worker. With the pandemic signalling a push to working from home, many businesses have seen their well-designed and hard-won office spaces lay empty for months. This in turn has put pressure on the inner city businesses who thrive on the daytime customer and has forced many of them to shut their doors, in some cases permanently. Although the central business districts of many Western nations are still looking rather deserted thanks to a second wave of COVID and the subsequent lockdowns that this has brought, a number of countries, especially in the East, have started to trickle back to the water cooler. So what can we learn from them? Well, I'm joined now from Toronto by Bill Nankivell, the CEO of B+H Architects.
How has this year impacted your business? How have you had to adapt to the way that you run your offices? Here you are, a design firm. You know how to implement change, to make things safe, to do the things that lots of us are being asked to do in a very high-speed way, I would imagine. But how has this hit your company?
Well, I think we probably, like a lot of other firms like ours and people in this business, we're actually pretty good with the tools for collaborative work. We have people in studios and clients all over the world who are never in meeting rooms together, who do a huge amount online. We have collaborative teams that work on very large building projects. So we had the basic tools, but to suddenly be thrown into shifting initially in our China practice to be 100% of everybody working from home for an initial sort of a 3 to 4 week period when China first went into a hard lockdown. Yeah, it was pretty challenging. I think one of the biggest challenges is that not everybody has the access to all the technology at home. So we had to pivot pretty quickly to how do we get people with the right amount of bandwidth and the right tools and the right hardware. But once we did that, it actually became fairly seamless pretty quickly for us to be able to connect, you know, and actually with a lot of our clients. So we do a lot of work in with tech sector clients, particularly in our workplace. They already largely collaborate virtually on most of their projects most of the time. So the tools were there, but shifting the entire business model was a challenge.
And tell us, you know, as the pandemic began in China and that country had to react first, were those your first offices who were required to work from home? And I know there's a cultural thing about going to the office in China. Was it difficult to persuade your teams to dissemble and head back home to work?
In China, this wasn't an option. It wasn't a preference. It was something the government simply said, everybody will stay home. This was right at the end of the Chinese New Year holiday. And it was mandatory. So that was, we had to follow that. Interestingly enough, over there, they also very quickly, the government said everybody back to work. So after their 3 to 4 week lockdown, by the end of February, we had everybody back in the office, although with pretty, you know, strict protocols, particularly around measuring temperature, and you needed to essentially have a QR code on your phone that said that you were not positive, that you were good to go to work, that you're participating in all these protocols. So there was a lot of rigor around that. And as I think we've sort of seen from China, they're probably the most successful at the end of the day in controlling it.
And do they offer you some lessons when you think about when the time comes for your offices in North America, for example, to return? Are there learnings there that you intend to adapt and introduce in your own offices, for example, in Toronto?
I think there were certainly learnings that we had about getting everybody back to work. And then it was also about respecting that not everybody can get back to work. And so even in the Shanghai situation, we had people who, for various reasons, usually it was around family situations, living with extended families, people who simply said, I still feel it would be unsafe for me to be in an office environment. It's interesting. We actually did a firm-wide survey at the end of the day. We used our experience as a research project. And the number one concern that people have about returning to the office when these are lifted, wherever it was in fact the commute and the potential exposure to infection from commuting. So we were respectful of that and adapted around that. We learned that in the China situation. And as we then unlocked, as we did in our other, so in Ho Chi Minh or in Hong Kong or starting to in Singapore, and as we see it rolling out in Canada and the United States, certainly we'll be respectful about what some of those concerns are and have a few more options out there for people.
I'm speaking to you from the very center of London, where we're in a period of extended lockdown for 4 weeks. And the city, it's not like the first lockdown. The city is much, much busier than it was the first time. The rules are slightly different. People have got used to living with this virus and perhaps more cautious and fearful as they were the first time around. But without a doubt, what you'd call the CBD for London is badly hit. Are you seeing that in all the places you're operating? Here you are, you're a planner, a developer of residential, somebody who inspires people what to do about retail. Do you feel that the battle of the CBD has been lost momentarily?
Oh, I think it has. So I do occasionally go into the CBD in Toronto, where our offices are sort of right in that downtown business district. And it's a ghost town. It is dead. There are very few people on the streets. There's very few people in the buildings. Certainly, we feel badly because we've spent a lot of time, I think particularly in the last quarter century as architects and as planners, on really investing in developing mixed-use CBDs. We went through a stage where the downtowns, particularly in the North American model, people were fleeing, they didn't choose to live there anymore. You know, we went through that period of time with the growth of the suburbs. And our downtowns were dead after kind of 6 p.m. and the end of the workday. We've spent so much energy in the last 25 years to really rebuild the most dense part of our cities as truly livable places with quality of residence and education facilities and retail and nightlife and all of that, that to suddenly see all of that abandoned, you know, during the kind of typical workday, I think it's a real pity. I think it's a real loss for what we've done. And we certainly hope that, I mean, I've seen some sort of discussion of a trend about returning to, you know, people fleeing to the suburbs or moving away from wanting to be in these high density cities we built. But if we don't actually find a way to return to really vibrant, mixed use, urban, dense centers, yeah, the future of the city is going to be very different. And I think quite a loss.
And do you, as people running a company, a big company in Toronto, do you feel a responsibility to plan and to chart a return to the CBD?
Oh, yes. Yep, absolutely. And I think we're all going to find ways that it is safe and it is manageable. It seems that the COVID-19, you know, as a virus, is not going to simply disappear. It looks like it's going to be a very long, slow process of fewer and fewer cases as time goes on. But yes, no, I think we do all have a responsibility. I mean, we're social creatures at heart. And now we, as a business, we're in the business of designing large buildings and large places where large groups of people congregate to work, to socialize, to be educated, to live. And I think people are going to crave that. And the longer this goes on, the more they're craving places to socialize. And if we can adapt and we can make them safe in terms of health and public health, we actually need to be on the edge of being innovative and trying to find what's that hybrid model that starts to get people back into the workplace in larger numbers and to kind of rebuild what the societies are in the center of our cities.
When you look at the work that B&H does, you're constructing meeting places, you're constructing spaces where people come together to co-work, you're refreshing the public realm. All of these things that only work when people are willing to come together and feel comfortable about being in close proximity to each other. Has this moment impacted the design process of the things that you're contemplating? Or even before there was hint of a successful vaccine, were you taking the long view and saying, okay, this will pass, you know, we can't adapt our designs and remake the projects we're already involved in just for this moment?
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we talked to a number of our clients, you know, as the scenario started unfolding and, you know, earlier this year, we had a number of large clients who truly, they said, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, everything will be the same. It will go back and, you know, I expect, you know, my office needs, my retail needs not to change. There are others who clearly said, yeah, we're going to be adopting to a more flexible work model. I mean, we even did our own survey internally and 73% of our staff came back and said they would like the option to work at home, you know, maybe 1 or 2 days a week. That is going to kind of change the model. And so what we've been doing with our clients, and we did start this fairly early on, you know, the first signs that things were opening up, we went to a number of them. We helped them with a two-stage kind of process. And one was to stabilize. So what do you need to do to your workplace right now to accommodate, you know, some people getting back in, or maybe the essential people who need to be, because there's also a lot of organizations are essential and still needed people in the workplace. So how do you stabilize this situation? Social distancing and guidelines and changes. First thing is you can move some furniture. You could put in some partitions. You could maybe upgrade air handling systems, which are probably one of the most critical pieces. And then helping them to strategize. And so what does that workplace look like 2 or 3 years from now when the pandemic and the virus is manageable, but people want more flexibility? But one of the interesting pieces out of the research also, though, was that while 70% of people want the ability to work remotely for 1, 2, maybe 3 days a week, the same amount of people want a dedicated workstation when they come into the workplace. And so what we're also seeing is this pushback on the idea of flexible, agile workplace, of, you know, hot desking or hoteling. People want their dedicated space and a bit of privacy and a bit of physical space around it when they choose to come into the studio. And that's going to be a big dilemma for a lot of businesses, for a lot of organizations that typically have many, many people in a workplace.
Bill, thank you for joining us. That was Bill Nankivell, CEO of B plus H Architects, joining us down the line from Toronto. Up next, we assess how New York might be able to reinvent its use of downtown office space while occupancy is low. You're listening to The Urbanist. Stay tuned. Many of our city centres have never been as quiet as they are right now. And while that is a concern for businesses who rely on footfall to bring in revenue, it may also provide opportunity for those with property downtown. With growing numbers of offices sitting vacant, be it temporary or permanent, one of the big hurdles to refitting real estate, the tenant, is often gone. So is it time that we went back to the drawing board when it comes to how we use our downtown floor space? Well, I'm joined now by Peyman Lodi, Senior Vice President of the Real Estate Bureau of New York. Peyman, you've been calling for a bit of a rethink when it comes to many of the city's lower grade office spaces. Can you firstly just paint a picture of where the CBD is right now? What's the situation in New York at this time?
Yeah, I would say from the summer, so say from August up until end of October, we were hovering at occupancy rates around 10 to 15%. That number is coming down slightly to the high single digits, around 10%, due to the increased cases that everyone is aware of.
Now, we're speaking to you on a day when a third vaccine seems to have passed muster and is going to be heading for the arms of people around the world in the coming weeks and months. But what's interesting whenever I speak to people in your situation is to get the feeling of what the state of mind is. Are you feeling that, you know, that some big measures do still need to be taken, or that it's a time to hold your nerve because actually within a year we could be back to how the world used to be? What's your feeling about what people who own properties in New York, what landlords, what tenants should be thinking at this moment?
Yeah, and I mean, today's news is welcome news. It's been a tough year and you're always looking for some sense of hope. And the news that we have a possible third vaccine that's quite effective, you know, lends a sense of optimism. The question still remains, how quickly can they deploy that? How soon could the general population be vaccinated? But there is a sense now that there's light at the end of the tunnel and the world will be changed. We don't really know how, we know it will be. And in just speaking with my colleagues and others in the city, friends, family, people are eager to get back into the office space and resume life as it was pre-pandemic. And, you know, for those owners and property developers, I think everyone's waiting for kind of the volatility to settle before they make any important decisions. Obviously, volatility is very bad for the investment market. It doesn't matter what investment market you're in, it's just not good. And so, you know, in terms of the impact to the economy, that's bad because you just don't have money cycling through the economy. There's a lack of investment. You know, we track investment sales, whether that be large commercial office buildings, multifamily residential, as well as condo and cooperative sales in the residential sector. And those numbers are down 40-50% from this time last year. And that's causing a big hit, not only on the economy, but on our local budgets in terms of municipal and state government budgets. We're talking about, you know, equally $40-50 billion. And just this year alone, just from the transaction taxes that would have accrued during this period of time, the city and the state are down $1.5 billion. I mean, these are big numbers. And the city as a whole relies on that tax revenue because that tax revenue is what helps pay for critical services like public safety, sanitation, transportation that the city so desperately relies on.
You wrote a piece recently was saying that actually maybe this is a time to rethink about rezoning, to try and add in more housing into these central parts of the city to keep them lively and ticking over. Is that still your feeling that will be something that will be tempting for both city and landlords and that could happen? Because I know it's a complicated and expensive thing to do. Are you still hopeful that that could be one of the things that mops up some of the excess space?
Yes. And we are looking at all sorts of policy measures that are going to speed up our economic recovery once we get out of this pandemic. And one of them, as you described, is the idea of converting older Class B and Class C office buildings to residential uses. And the easiest way to think about these Class B and C office buildings is that these are the older buildings that are not as amenity rich. They don't have the on-site building management or attended lobbies or the most modern HVAC systems or fast and reliable Wi-Fi systems. So you have to imagine in this environment, those are the sorts of things that office workers are really looking forward to. And you know, there's a high demand for that Class A premier office space. And the question becomes what to do with the Class B and C office space, which, not to discount this, but they do serve a purpose. They provide low rent spaces for nonprofits and startup companies to get their footing and to have a foothold in New York City. And I think it's important to note that not only do they serve a purpose, but as we look to this idea of conversions in the future, not all of them are going to convert, but you do, the city does need to facilitate the ability for Class B and C office spaces to convert to residential uses. And specifically, areas that we're looking at are within Manhattan's Central Business District, in areas like East Midtown, the Garment District, and Midtown South, where you don't have as much of a even or 50-50 blend between residential and commercial. So the idea here is, if we can take some of these Class B and C office buildings and convert them to residential uses, can we turn some of these neighborhoods that are not as lively or really have more of a 9-to-5 feeling into a true live, work, play neighborhood? And there's precedent here. We saw this happen in Lower Manhattan in the early 90s and continue to now. Just to give context here, in the early 90s, Lower Manhattan had a commercial vacancy rate of somewhere hovering around 25%. And the state developed an incentive program that allowed for the conversion of these older office buildings to residential uses. And after 9/11, the Great Recession, Hurricane Sandy, Lower Manhattan was able to weather all those periods of tumult and volatility because they were trending towards more of a live, work, play neighborhood. And to this day, they've added something like 25,000 residential units just in that neighborhood alone. And so we have a model that has worked in Lower Manhattan, and the thinking is, shouldn't that be reapplied, or shouldn't we examine reapplying that in neighborhoods where you don't have that mix? So again, like East Midtown and the Garment District. And the Garment District in particular is an interesting, both of these neighborhoods are interesting, but Garment District in particular, because you've got fantastic transit access in a neighborhood that historically, you know, a lot of garment manufacturing was taking place. Well, fast forward to 2020, that's not the case anymore. There's really no manufacturing going on. And so how do you transform these neighborhoods to reflect the new 2020 realities?
What are the kind of hurdles to that? Is it expensive? Do the existing neighbors oppose the change? What are the problems about converting these buildings?
I mean, there are political challenges. You're always going to have that anytime you want to transform a neighborhood in a meaningful way. But the key is to work with the stakeholders and come together to develop a plan that works for everyone and the city regionally. But let's just take a building, for example. Not all of them are going to be candidates for conversion. Some of them have huge floor plates, and they could never really accommodate a residential use. It is very expensive to convert, just the cost alone, but it's also the opportunity cost. You have to empty out your buildings, you have to retrofit your spaces, and then you have to lease up your spaces. So you're talking about a process, you know, where you're not collecting rent for several years while you go through that transformation. And some of these older buildings may be candidates for renovations towards Class A office buildings. It's just a matter of how much capital an owner has to spend to do these sorts of necessary improvements.
One of the other criticisms, I guess, in every city is that you have a group of owners of buildings, of companies, which are not just owned by an individual who can kind of make a deal on the day and decide, actually, this year I'm going to take a bit less rent or I'm going to convert this building, but they're locked into kind of institutional investments, which makes it very difficult for them to kind of chop and change about what their ambitions are and even to kind of negotiate on rent. You know, I know even before this began in many cities, including New York, you had often lots of vacant stores. And people said the problem is because the landlord would like to potentially budge or the agent would like to potentially budge on price, but it's such a chain of people behind who are looking for return on investment every year that they don't want to kind of negotiate down. Is it difficult also on that side to get people to say, okay, maybe I'll have a change of idea about what this building does and actually maybe I'll let it go to affordable housing and not think about converting it into the most expensive condos that I can imagine?
Yeah, I think what you're touching upon is very important, which is that there's an ecosystem involved here. And, you know, policymakers can't take the simple approach of, okay, well, if we just control rents, then we'll get the desired effect that we want. There's so many different players involved. There's lenders, as you mentioned, there's partners, and there's the long-term property owners. This requires everyone's cooperation. And we're in an instance right now where everyone's kind of revisiting and seeing how is all this going to land. So it's an opportunity for us, for everyone in that ecosystem, everyone involved, to take a look and say, well, what is going to best position us moving forward? What's going to be the best way that we can position the assets that we have right now, looking out 20, 30 years from now?
What's fascinating, though, is it's quite encouraging talking to you because the things you're talking about, you know, this idea of families, young people wanting to live in the downtown core, whether, you know, that was in the past years around Wall Street, making that a more of an area for hotels and all sorts of things, or in the Garment District. You know, because lots of people in the newspapers, you read all these headlines, you know, that everyone's fleeing for the suburbs and they will never come back. They've taken a one-way ticket, that, you know, we will look at the depopulation of our city cores as we had during what was oddly called white flight, but, you know, in the 50s and 60s. But you don't seem to think that. You seem to think that the energy and the excitement of a city core done well will always be appealing.
Yes, and I think the key is done well. And the city has to always look to evolve. And throughout our history, we have evolved. We've diversified our economy. We've addressed serious issues of quality of life, and we've retained that vibrancy that makes it so attractive to generation after generation of young people and young families and the workforce that is the lifeblood of our city. This is something that I think we're all pretty bullish on, looking out at the future. And just to give you some indication, because I don't think it gets enough attention, but if you look at these headlines that say work from home is going to be here to stay, I think some element of that is certainly the case. But when you really look at who's signing leases and big office buildings, well, it's these big tech companies like Amazon, Facebook, and TikTok, who are probably best positioned in terms of their workforce to be working from home. And what are they doing? But they're doubling down. They're taking more space. They recognize the inherent value of in-person communication and cooperation.
Payman Lodi, Senior Vice President of the Real Estate Bureau of New York, thank you for joining us. Finally today, we want to offer some tips for cities trying to ensure the health of their downtown districts for the years to come, and perhaps even encourage them to come out of the pandemic looking even better than before. Here's the show's producer, Carlotta Rebello.
Go green. While footfall and traffic is low, we've all had a chance to breathe some fresh air in our city centres. We think now is the ideal time for city centres to give greenification a go. At worst, it will be a short-lived gesture of goodwill during a tough time. At best, it will be a new green space that will last well beyond the pandemic. Slow down. Statistics have shown that less cars on the road has actually contributed to more traffic-related accidents and injuries. With more space, drivers have felt confident to pay less attention and put their foot down. Why not look to reduce speed limits around the CBD, or better yet, follow Barcelona's lead and find areas where you can kick out the car altogether? It's sure to coax back any overly cautious pedestrians. Spot an opening. Now might be the perfect time for new business owners to get their start in an area that may have previously been out of reach. Cities should encourage first-timers to be the engine for a downtown renaissance, designing versatile eating spaces with al fresco in mind, or retail with a bit more wriggle room. Those are ideas we can get behind, virus or not. Shout from the rooftops. We've spoken before here on The Urbanist about the hidden gems that sit atop our office blocks and apartment towers. Why not harness the naturally well-ventilated space that is the city rooftop for anything from drinking and dining to markets and even outdoor cinema? Think again. Empty shop fronts are a discouraging sign, and they don't give landlords much to feel confident about either. Perhaps temporary installations can help liven up the street and provide something for building owners at the same time. Whether it's on the artistic side with temporary galleries or the altruistic side like a pop-up food bank. Find a route through. Encouraging pedestrians isn't just about breaking down barriers. Why not draw them in too with public art? A well-curated art wall can get feet back on the pavements and unlock areas of the CBD that aren't as familiar, but are just as charming. Lower your guard. It might be time to loosen restrictions just a little to allow a bit more placemaking to occur around the city centre. Sure, when the city is in full flow, thoroughfares are important, but could a food truck park there? Could a market use that square when it's not full of estate agents on a lunch break? Maybe put that red tape in the drawer for now. It can always come back out when things start to pick up again. For Monocle 24, I'm Carlotta Rebello.
Well, that's all we have for this edition of the programme. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Rebello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, here's Petula Clark with Downtown. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.